And if you compare what was read there with what we considered last week, there are many differences that stand out. And we're going to get to that, but I do want to point out that actually, in one significant way, what was read, 18:1-12, is parallel to the passage we considered last week at the end of chapter 17. And that is that both of these passages have to do with nations that are related to the nation Israel. You may remember, hopefully you do, that we were talking about the Amalekites at the end of chapter 17. And they were related to Israel in that they were descendants of Esau, Jacob's brother. You cross the line into chapter 18, and the focus here is on a man by the name of Jethro. He is Moses' father-in-law, and we are told or reminded that he was a Midianite. And the Midianites were also related to the nation Israel through another line. Actually, they go back even earlier than the Amalekites because they descended from a son of Abraham by his second wife, Keturah. And so you're talking about Israel making its way through the desert and at or around Mount Sinai and these maybe to us unexpected encounters with these people groups that they're related to. But that is as far as the comparison goes, because what actually happens is totally different in this case. In chapter 17, the Amalekites attacked Israel. That is not at all what Jethro the Midianite does in this chapter. He actually does the opposite. He joins the people of God in confessing the glory of Yahweh as the great deliverer. How was it that Jethro took that spirit and adopted that mindset? What happens that moves him to confess faith in Yahweh in this chapter? We find the answer in what I would call the core of this passage, which is verse 8. Look with me at that statement in verse 8. Then Moses told his father-in-law all that Yahweh had done to Pharaoh and to the Egyptians for Israel's sake, all the hardship that had come upon them in the way, and how Yahweh had delivered them. What prompted Jethro to have the kind of response to the Lord that he does at the end of this passage is that Moses, his son-in-law, told him something. Now, that key word, told, seems pretty ordinary, but I want us to look at it more closely. In its basic form, that verb means to count, as in to go through numbers or to number something. In the form that occurs here, we would say you could translate it with the word recount, as in to give a report of something. That's the idea, the reporting. And yet, depending in whatever passage it occurs, what is being recounted and how it's being recounted, that reporting idea could actually get across a stronger sense. In fact, here is how it is translated, that same word in the same form earlier in Exodus. It is in God's words to Pharaoh in Exodus chapter 9 and verse 16 that has everything to do with what we're looking at here. Here's what the Lord said to Pharaoh. But indeed, for this reason, I have allowed you to remain in order to show you my power and in order to proclaim my name through all the earth. That word translated proclaim. What God was working to do in dealing as he did with Pharaoh, that his name would be proclaimed through all the earth. That is the same term here, and I believe that in this passage it actually carries that same flavor, proclamation. But what is it that Moses is reporting or proclaiming in this case? He is telling Jethro about God's work through the Exodus, and specifically, as it says toward the end of the verse, how Yahweh had delivered his people. And we want to think about that word delivered as well. That term deliver means to rescue from trouble, to snatch people out of danger. It occurs numerous times in Exodus to speak about the Exodus itself, and it occurs in this passage, in these 12 verses, five times we're going to run across the word deliver. So, Moses is proclaiming deliverance. That's what's happening as we put all this together. The proclamation of divine deliverance. We could use that for the title of this message, but I'd like to use a little bit different words to state the theme that we want to consider that ties together this passage. It actually comes from another book of the Old Testament. And it comes from a passage that was read for us Tuesday night in our testimony service as we were anticipating Thanksgiving. That passage is Psalm 107. And it's one of these cases where we find little vignettes of history, the history of God's people, the celebration of some of God's mighty works. And the passage begins with this call to worship, Psalm 107, verse 1. Oh, give thanks to the Lord, for he is good, for his steadfast love endures forever. That's the call to worship, the invitation. Give thanks to the Lord. And then verse 2 states it in a different way when it tells us, let the redeemed of the Lord say so, whom he has redeemed from trouble. And I'm sure you're familiar with that kind of language. Let the redeemed of the Lord say so. I like the way that the Net Bible translates it. Maybe not as poetic, but maybe a little stronger. It says, let those delivered by the Lord speak out. Raise your voice and talk about it, or proclaim it, we might say. The point is that something as stunning as divine deliverance really cannot be kept quiet. This is something you have to talk about. This is something that you ought to be constrained to proclaim because of all the amazing things that God has done on behalf of his people. Let the redeemed of the Lord say so. That's the theme of the message this morning, because that is what this passage is directing us toward as it gives us this story of Moses and Jethro. We're not simply reading about some kind of historical event where these two people had an interesting conversation and that's the extent of it. This passage is showing us through their example that this kind of proclamation and the response that goes along with it is the only fitting response for anybody who has experienced divine deliverance. Let the redeemed of the Lord say so. And that idea develops in this passage in three movements. As we look at the first part of this passage in verses 1 to 7, here is how I would frame those verses. Providence arranges an opportunity for the proclamation of divine deliverance. Let me say that again. Providence arranges an opportunity for the proclamation of divine deliverance. In other words, the Lord ordained these circumstances where Jethro shows up and is keenly interested in what took place to give Moses an opportunity, a platform for him to say the kinds of things that he did. Providence arranges an opportunity for the proclamation of divine deliverance. Now, we are introduced right off the bat to Jethro, as in our version anyway, the first word of verse 1. And yet, we have learned about him before. We encountered this man, Jethro, all the way back in chapter 2 of Exodus. And you remember the story. After Moses had reacted foolishly to the plight of his people, He killed an Egyptian, and after that, he ran away. He fled as far as he could from Pharaoh, who was seeking his life. And he ends up in the providence of God, far away in Midian. And when he arrives there, he comes across seven sisters who were at a well with their flocks, and yet they weren't able to draw water for those animals because a group of shepherds was there keeping them away until they got theirs taken care of. And in chapter 2, verse 17, we read this, that Moses stood up, this total stranger showing up here, seeing what is happening. Moses stood up and saved them and watered their flock. Even that bit of wording is intriguing, because here's this man whose life would seem to be a failure at this point, who thought he was going to save the people of God and fell flat on his face, and yet the very next thing he's doing is he is saving somebody. In other words, he has this in him. He is the instrument of God's deliverance, and he is associated, even during this time when he seems to be like offline of what God is doing, he is still associated with this work of salvation. And as you read that story, chapter 2 identifies the father of those seven women as the priest of Midian. We discover that he goes by two names, the name Reuel and the name Jethro, which seems to be the more common one. And Jethro is so thankful for what Moses had done. He saw good character there and a good potential for somebody to help him. So he hires Moses as a shepherd and also gives him his daughter Zipporah as his wife. That was chapter 2 of Exodus. And the next time, really the last time before this in chapter 18, is in chapter 4. And this is after Moses has had that dramatic experience where the Lord appeared to him at the burning bush, calls him to go to Egypt to deliver his people. And after all of this back and forth with God, Moses finally gives in and he has to start to make arrangements. And so he needs to talk to his boss and father-in-law. And it says in chapter 4, verse 18, that he went back to Jethro and said to him, "Please let me go back to my brothers in Egypt to see whether they are still alive." I think we talked about that when we dealt with chapter 4. You kind of wonder what he was thinking or whether he was totally convinced that this plan of God was going to pan out. He at least says, "I'm going to see whether they are still alive." Not exactly the truth, or not the whole truth. But whatever the case, Jethro says to him, very simply, "Go in peace." He's not like another situation with a father-in-law in this whole storyline that goes back to Genesis, where Laban is so upset when Jacob leaves him, particularly under the circumstances that he did. He is willing to let him go. He wishes him well. He is supportive of this decision. And so the story goes on in verse 20, that Moses took his wife and his sons, had them ride on a donkey, went back to the land of Egypt, and Moses took the staff of God in his hand. Now, that's all that we knew about this whole scenario with Jethro and Zipporah and the sons of Moses. We come now to chapter 18 and we learn a new detail. And that is that at some point after leaving for Egypt, Moses had sent Zipporah and those boys back to Jethro. We don't know when exactly in the process. We don't know why exactly this happened. And there are many theories. Maybe it had something to do with that really strange story at the end of chapter 4, if you remember this, regarding the circumcision of one of Moses' sons, where God was about to kill Moses over his failure to circumcise. Zipporah steps in to take care of that. She says, "You are a bridegroom of blood to me." And there are those who think that there was a lot of tension between them as a couple, and maybe that had something to do with it. Maybe, this is probably the more common understanding, is that as they, as a family, get into Egypt, things begin to heat up between Moses and Pharaoh, to where it was a pretty dangerous thing for him to have his family there alongside of him. So he's concerned for their safety, and he makes a decision to send them back temporarily with the understanding that they will be reunited once that the nation is on the other side. Or maybe Zipporah and those boys went through the entire experience of the Exodus, but once they cross the Red Sea and they start making their way through the desert, Moses actually sends them as a small group ahead of him to go and get Jethro so they could all be reunited when the people of God gather there at Mount Sinai. Those are some possible scenarios. Whatever the explanation, throughout these stories, Exodus has been teaching us in a lot of different ways that the Lord, given his special care for all of these events in the redemption of his people, the Lord has been superintending every detail of the story so that everything that he desires to accomplish is going to get accomplished. And so it is natural to expect, against that background, even though we don't know all the information we might like, it is natural to expect that when they are finally reunited, it is the Lord who is behind it. And God has been directing the circumstances to work out this meeting. In fact, I believe the passage gives us three pointers to the idea of God's providence in all of this. And let me show those to you. First of all, even the introduction of Jethro in this story, and his identification as a priest of Midian, and the statement that he had heard of all that God had done for Moses and for Israel's people, how the Lord had brought Israel out of Egypt. Do we have any background that would lead us to expect that's a pretty significant event? That the word of the Exodus has begun to spread to the nations of the world? This was actually in that verse I read from chapter 9, one of God's purposes, that his name would be proclaimed throughout the earth. God wanted the story of the Exodus to get out there. And now it did get out there to one of these nations that Jethro was a part of. And this is part of God communicating to us my program for the wide proclamation of my character and my redemption. It's taking a little step forward here as this one person who's not an Israelite is getting the message, and he's making a move toward me. Anytime we read about the message of Yahweh getting to the nations, in the Old Testament especially, we ought to pay attention. And we ought to connect this really with the whole purpose of the Abrahamic covenant. I come back to this again and again, that when God first promised to Abraham that he was going to bless him and do amazing things for his people, it is not so that blessing will end with this one family, but that through him, all families of the earth would be blessed. And here is one of those families showing an interest in Yahweh, the God of Israel, responding to the story that Jethro had heard. And in fact, as we look forward into the next chapter, we find that this emphasis continues, because in chapter 19, when the Lord is laying the foundation for the new arrangement that he's going to make with this nation, we call it the Mosaic Covenant, he says that his purpose for that is basically the same as the purpose of the Abrahamic Covenant. He says, I'm going to make you a kingdom of priests. And we'll have to deal with that later when we get to chapter 19, but I'm saying here is one little token indication that God is serious about accomplishing that purpose. As now Israel is mediating the knowledge of God to this one man who is from some other nation. God is at work there in his providence. A second indication of the providence of God in all of this is the statements in verses 3 and 4 about the meanings of the names of Moses' sons. Look at verse 3. The name of the one was Gershom, for he said, I have been a sojourner in a foreign land. That is basically a repetition of what it says back in chapter 2, verse 22, when Gershom was born. And there is a connection, there's a play on words between the Hebrew terms ger, alien, and shom, there, and it communicates that Moses, when this baby is born, is associating it with his sojourning time, his sense that he's an alien, a foreigner, away from this his own people. And it makes the point that during those 40 years in Midian, Moses had a sense that he did not belong there. That this was a temporary situation, that God's will for him was to be reunited with his people. Eventually they would go to their own land. But over here in Midian, he is far away from that, and he knew that, meaning that he was not really putting his roots down there permanently. He had a sense God had something more for him, that his life was kind of on hold. This wasn't the ultimate plan. That's the emphasis of the name Gershom. And what about the second son? Actually, it's new information to the reader of Exodus that the second son, his name is Eliezer. And his name is kind of a play on the idea that God is the helper of Moses. Or as he says, he named him that because he said, the God of my father was my help, and he delivered me from the sword of Pharaoh. And so he's fled from Egypt. He has escaped execution by Pharaoh. He goes over there and he wants to testify, God kept me safe. God helped me through that threat. And every time we call this boy's name, Eliezer, we're confessing God is my help, and he's keeping that concept, that truth alive. Knowing that Midian for that time was a place provided by God for his safety. Now, that's all very interesting, but as we're reading here about Moses and Jethro, that information really isn't necessary to the story. In other words, you can pull out verses 3 to 4 and just jump from chapter 18, verse 2, and keep reading then in verse 5 about Jethro, and you really wouldn't miss a beat as far as the basics of this story. My point is that the author, Moses himself, has included that bit of information. It really is more background. It's not a part of this story because as the story unfolds, he wants to remind you of these truths about the Lord. He is slowing down the narrative and he is using the names to bring before the reader certain ideas because those ideas are significant for understanding the events that he's recording in this passage. He's giving that as an additional testimony to the Lord's deliverance of him. And he is tying in all these different events, how God had carefully watched over him in his providence and now brought him back to the same area after doing everything he did in the Exodus. He just is shouting all over the place the work of God sovereignly moving all of these events and people around so that his redemption can go forward. I like the way that one commentator put this. Together, the names Gershom and Eliezer told the story of Moses' life. I was a stranger there, but God is my helper. I was a stranger there, but God is my helper. These two names also describe what was happening to the nation of Israel. Like Moses, the Israelites were strangers in Egypt, but God was their helper. He saved them from Pharaoh's sword. And then the author goes on to say, we make the same transition when we come to faith in Jesus Christ. We move from sin with all the alienation it brings to salvation in which we acknowledge God as our only hope. It's not a bad way to give your testimony. Through the summary of those names, I was a stranger there, but God is my help. Again, he throws that into the middle of this story to speak to us of the providential direction and help of God. But there's another, a third element here that undergirds this point about how God providentially is arranging for all of this, and that is the detail about the location of this encounter between Moses and Jethro. And the location is the mountain of God. Look at verse 5. Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, came with his sons and his wife to Moses in the wilderness, where he was encamped at the mountain of God. That's no small thing. We've actually encountered that expression only two times before in Exodus. It has come up, but only twice. When was the first time? It was at that burning bush incident. This was in the same region where the Lord appeared to him and called him to his work. And that was in chapter 3. At the end of chapter 4, it's mentioned again because as Moses, having gone and taken his leave from Jethro and starting to make his way to Egypt, he actually stops there again, and that's where the Lord directed Aaron to meet him so that they could get reconnected, so that they could get prepared, make plans for the work that they were to do in Egypt. Now, that any mountain, a specific mountain, should be called the mountain of God and should have that sort of background to it ought to tell us that this is a place of unusual significance. It ought to tell us that we ought to read carefully that probably the next thing to be recorded that happens at this place is also of unusual significance. That God is kind of headquartered there. This is like, at this point, his base of operations. This is where he called Moses. This is where he met, that Moses met Aaron to get the thing going. And now this is where he and Jethro are going to have their meeting as well. God has directed in those details. The Lord had called him from that point. Now he has brought him full circle. And what happens next is not just a big family reunion, but it is a grand celebration of the redemption that the Lord had sent Moses out to accomplish from that very spot. Now, as we think about this point, about God's providence, setting up in detail the arrangements for this conversation, we understand that this is a unique event in the history of redemption. And like with all of these stories, I am working hard not to spiritualize this passage and to somehow make it all about us. This is about the Lord, ultimately. And yet the truths that we find reflected here, they certainly do bear application to our lives as well. And I'll put it to you this way. God's providence, just like it superintended Moses' life, is also working to superintend our lives. And just like in his case, that providence was redemptively focused and was opening up opportunities for the proclamation of redemption, we can expect that God works in our experience in the same way. And I would take it based on all kinds of other scriptures, down to the level of the smallest details of our lives, which would include like things like the families that we were born into, the experiences we have early on in life, the different places where we live at different stages in our lives, the people that we are connected with, whether it's our immediate family, or like in this case, our more extended family, or other relationships. All of these are ordained by God. I'm sure Moses at the time did not think that God was using this kind of pause period in his life the way that he was. And yet the Lord was engaged, was actively participating in directing him, preparing him, setting the stage for using all of those details of his experience, weaving them into this bigger picture of redemption. And folks, we have to believe the same. That these kinds of connections in our lives, these circumstances. They don't happen by chance. That there is a God in heaven who is ordaining the circumstances of our lives, and part of what he's doing is he is connecting us with individual people in whose lives we are to have a redemptive ministry as well. God's providence is superintending our circumstances with that kind of redemptive purpose. And that brings us then to the core of the passage here in verse 8. And we read this verse already because it's the core statement where Moses speaks out. Let the redeemed of the Lord speak out. That's what he does. And let me summarize this verse as follows. Faith engages in a full-orbed proclamation of divine deliverance. He is persuaded that God is the one who's done these things, and that God is worthy of being proclaimed in everything that he has just finished up. Faith engages in a full-orbed proclamation of divine deliverance. Now I say full-orbed, and that's because verse 8 says, then Moses told his father-in-law all that the Lord had done to Pharaoh and to the Egyptians for Israel's sake. All the hardships that had come upon them in the way, and how the Lord had delivered them. With that emphasis on this being a comprehensive conversation, you kind of wonder how long they were in that tent and how much time this conversation took. It would seem to have taken quite a while if Moses goes blow by blow through the whole story that we have spent several months here in our services trying to follow and trying to understand. In fact, maybe the oral rehearsing of that story is part of what God used to help Moses recover the details so that in time he would put it down in writing as we have it today. What do you think they talked about? What is included in this all? Let me remind you. That probably included the story of how when Moses got there the first time, he was immediately rejected by Pharaoh. In fact, Pharaoh increased the workload of the Israelites and made them go out and get their own straw for their bricks. And now they are not only working harder, but their deliverance seems even more impossible, and they start to turn on Moses, the Israelites do. Maybe Moses just said, at that low point in my life, the Lord revealed himself to me in another way, and he assured me that he was in fact going to work, but it was actually going to take quite a while and quite a complicated process. And let me tell you some of what that involved. There were 9 destructive plagues that the Lord systematically brought upon that nation of Egypt. The water turned to blood. The frogs that overran the land, as well as, number 3, the gnats. And then there was the second set of 3, the flies, the disease on the cattle, and the boils. And then there was the third set of 3, the hail, the locusts, and the darkness. And as all these things, Jethro, were unfolding, there were a few times when Pharaoh seemed like he was breaking and decided to give in a little bit, but eventually, and pretty quickly, his heart became hard again, and he refused to let us go, and things got worse and worse. But then there was the climax of the 10th plague, the death of the firstborn of the Egyptians. The wonderful thing about that is that God gave us a way by which we could express our faith in him, and that was to kill this Passover lamb, and we applied the blood to the post of our door. When the death angel came by, that angel spared us. He passed over us, and none of our firstborn was killed. And yet even that's not the end of the story. Because as we were scurrying to get out of there, and Pharaoh was insistent that we leave right away, We actually plundered the Egyptians. They were willing to just give us all kinds of stuff. Look at all this wealth that we now have. And then as we began to step out by faith and we needed to know where to go, there was this miraculous appearance of a cloud by day and a pillar of fire by night. And God just moved around that expression, that manifestation of his presence, and it told us exactly where to go next. And yet even that's not the end, because pretty quickly Pharaoh changed his mind one more time. And he gathered his troops and they came chasing after us. And God parted the Red Sea so that we could cross. And as we got to the other side, he brought those waters crashing down on the forces of Egypt. I can only imagine the excitement of Moses as here he is, apparently for the first time, having the opportunity to proclaim those mighty redemptive works of Yahweh to someone who had not witnessed them himself, someone who had not gone through those events. And here he's talking to his father-in-law, who I'm sure knew some of Moses' struggles. And here is this man, 80 years old, this once depressed shepherd, who thought his life was on hold, now seeing clearly what the Lord had been up to, and he just explodes with the declaration of the mighty acts of God. He is persuaded that God is able to do everything he promised, and he wants our people to know about it as well. But notice that this is not just about really exciting events and things were always going well for the people of God. In that verse 8, it says he also spoke to them, to Jethro, about all the hardship that had come on the way. This wasn't a one-side, glossy sort of a depiction. He isn't omitting all of the trials that we have been considering the last few weeks in the last couple of chapters of Exodus. The overwhelming thirst, the overwhelming hunger, the fearful attack by the Amalekites. Moses is not giving the impression that life with the Lord or the redeemed life is a bed of roses on this earth. He is very honest about the difficulties of what is involved in following Yahweh as your God. And yet, he is bringing out most of all that the same God who took Israel through those times of intense need, he faithfully met every one of those needs, and he used those provisions to make himself better known to his people. He was superintending even the trial for the purpose of growing them in the knowledge of God. Now, as I read about Moses and just connecting that little statement of verse 8 with everything we've read in Exodus, how can we not think about our own role in making known the salvation of God to those around us? Indeed, to all the nations of the world, which is what is beginning to happen here. I mean, if God is God, and if Jesus has died to redeem sinners, and if he is also risen from the dead, and if you and I have experienced total forgiveness and justification through him, and if he is sustaining us and providing for us through all of the trials of life, and if he is coming again to deliver us totally from all the effects of sin and to put down all evil in the world, how can we not declare his glories to the world around us? I believe this is where this story is pointing us. And Moses' example, as I've thought about it, has convicted me. And it has challenged me afresh to be looking for opportunities in God's providence to proclaim the gospel to those who are lost. And we have a great providential opportunity for that as we enter this Christmas season. Is it too extreme? Is it too burdensome to imagine that over the next month, as we are celebrating the incarnation of our Savior, each of us, as we seek the Lord and we are alert, could have one substantial opportunity to evangelize somebody before the end of this year? Is that unrealistic? Is that an impossibility? Is that not the spirit of Moses having experienced everything that he has come through? I trust the Lord will encourage us to take up that challenge. And we are further encouraged to do that as we see how this passage ends. We've already seen that, number one, providence arranges an opportunity for the proclamation of divine deliverance. Number two, that faith engages in a full-orb proclamation of divine deliverance. And now, finally, number three, God receives glory through the proclamation of divine deliverance. Verses 9 to 12. God receives the glory when this message goes out in the way that Moses put it out. And we're looking here at the response of Jethro to the story. You have these just classic elements that are reflective of a genuine faith and an embrace of what is being proclaimed. First of all, look at verse 9. There's joy. And Jethro rejoiced for all the good that Yahweh had done to Israel and that he had delivered them out of the hand of the Egyptians. Moses' enthusiasm rubbed off on Jethro, and he as well overflowed with delight. There is that joy. And then a lot of this is about worship. That's another response. Look at verse 10. Jethro said, "Blessed be the Lord who has delivered you out of the hand of the Egyptians and out of the hand of Pharaoh, and has delivered the people from under the hand of the Egyptians." You see, there are two of the five times that word for deliverance shows up. Jethro is borrowing the language of Moses to express his own understanding of what had taken place. And it reminds me of the way that the people of Israel responded when they first got to the other side of the Red Sea. Remember that, chapter 15? That great worship service on the other side of the Red Sea, as they are singing about the great deliverance that they had observed, God's victory over the Egyptians. This verse is like Jethro's little version of Exodus 15. They had their own song over there. It took up a whole chapter. Here, it's a shorter version, but it's the same spirit of how can these things not be celebrated? He had just heard about the proclamation of divine deliverance, and he immediately wants to join in that proclamation and blesses the Lord for what he had done. And then, very important, at verse 11. "Now I know that Yahweh is greater than all gods, because in this affair they dealt arrogantly with the people." Now I know. There's a personalization of this. And some people understand that statement as the moment of Jethro's actual conversion to Yahweh. That is possible. Or it may be that he already believed in Yahweh, and those words indicate a climactic confirmation of his faith. Or perhaps before, his understanding was a bit confused. And he believed in Yahweh, but there was still a mixture of some other kind of gods in his mind. And now he comes to a decided and understanding moment here of declaring his faith. Either way, whatever his spiritual condition was before this, I don't know. But I don't want us to miss that the verse presents his response with the word "no." Now I know this. That should not be a surprise to us, because we have seen this theme again and again tying together all of Exodus. That it's all God's doing what he's doing so that my people may know me, so that they would come to an experiential knowledge of me. That's been my purpose in redemption. And now it's this non-Israelite who's having that experience as well. He's come to a knowledge of God or a deeper knowledge of God through what he has heard. And don't miss another theme that we have seen before in Exodus. And that is that the Exodus was also a battle between the gods. Notice he says, Yahweh is greater than all gods, because in this affair they dealt arrogantly with the people. You remember what we saw over there in the stories of the plagues, that in addition to those events bringing judgment on Egypt, there were also all these connections between different elements of nature and the gods of Egypt. And so whether the Egyptians were worshiping the Nile or the sun or the forces of the weather or frogs or whatever it might be, God was again and again showing his supremacy over the supposed God that was behind those aspects of nature. He covers it all. He is sovereign over all. And that point is being made here. The expression at the end of the verse is a little hard to translate. In our version it says, because in this affair they dealt arrogantly with the people. You may be looking at a New King James version, which is a little more literal, and it says, in the very thing in which they behaved proudly, he was above them. And I think that gets at the point. In the very thing in which they were so proud, these gods and their worshipers saying, I'm in charge of the Nile, I'm in charge of the light of the sun. In all of those areas where they were so arrogantly claiming these powers to themselves, he was demonstrating, no, I am above you. I am sovereign over you. In all of those realms, he demonstrated his supremacy. No wonder that Jethro caps off his worship the way he does in verse 12, when it says that Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, brought a burnt offering and sacrifices to God. We might have other ways that we do that, but it's the spirit of I want to show God that I'm convinced. I want to recognize him as the supreme God he is. I want to give him something. And particularly the burnt offering had this idea of everything about me. My whole life is being set apart and devoted to God. I belong to him now. I want to symbolize that by burning up, in this case, the entire animal. But that's not even the end of it. There's a little bit left in verse 12. We've seen this man Jethro in his joy, in his worship, but then there is also a note of fellowship with other believers, as verse 12 says that Aaron came with all the elders of Israel to eat bread with Moses' father-in-law before God. That's what we call a communal meal, where as a part of worship, not too different from our Lord's table, they are gathering together, they're offering some things to God, but they're also enjoying other things in the presence of God, that this act of worship has bound them together as fellow believers and fellow worshipers. God's people celebrating together their joint faith in him as the deliverer. And now it's not just the Israelites, now Jethro is involved in this. Folks, that kind of joy, that kind of worship, that kind of fellowship, that kind of glory to God, it comes as a result of Moses standing up and speaking out, not keeping it in. It is his proclamation of God's deliverance that the Lord used to bring about that kind of response. And I pray that the Lord will be pleased to work through us in somebody's life, even this Christmas, the same result. As we take up the challenge to let the redeemed of the Lord say so, we're going to say so in song. And I've chosen for our closing, and as a way of where we're really beginning to wrap up the Exodus story and this opening part of